Hello and welcome to this week's instalment of Nucleus Investment Insights. This week, our focus returns to the rising problem of achieving a sufficient level of income from your invested capital, with another special guest sharing their views and insights. As with a lot of things in life, it all seems so much easier in the past. The combination of safe defensive assets such as government and corporate bonds, and even the humble term deposit, could often be relied upon for a reasonably stable income flow that was sufficient for a comfortable retirement. But oh, how the times have changed. With term deposit rates now falling into laughable territory, especially against inflation, anxiety building on where money should be invested that can create a return that meets basic expenditure, let alone a comfortable retirement. Joining us today to help answer the question, is growth the new yield? We are very fortunate to be joined by Angela Ashton. Angela is founder and director of Evergreen Consultants and Evergreen Ratings, an independent investment consultancy company that specialises in helping independent financial planners, small institutions, platforms and fund managers alike. Angela Ashton, welcome to Nucleus Investment Insights.
Thank you.
Great to have you on.
Thanks. Fantastic.
And here to run through our thoughts on the future of income, I'm also joined by Nucleus Wealth's Head of Investments, Damien Klassen. Hello to you, Damien.
Hi, Tim.
And also joining us today, we have our Head of Operations, Shelley George. G'day, Shelley.
Hi, Tim.
Great to have you on as well. And just a quick reminder that before we get started, to subscribe on YouTube and click on the notification bell to be notified of when we go live or have a new webinar to watch, or follow us on your preferred podcast platform. Feel free to click like on the video now to help our show grow. And for those listening in live, of course, feel free to drop in your questions in the chat box in the YouTube's comment box to have them answered along the way. So we'll jump into our agenda for today. And for those that have been following the show, we'll know this is the second part of our achieving or looking for income focus that we're doing. So what we're going to be doing is just a current market update to sort of change it up a little bit. We'll then be looking at COVID and income. We'll then be looking, of course, to the future of income or for income. And then finally, of course, wrapping out into the investment outlook and how we incorporate these themes every day here in the portfolios at Nucleus Wealth. So to get us started, we've got our market update, and I'll hand over to Shelley George to get the ball rolling.
Thanks very much, Tim. Before I actually go to the markets update and the slide that we have on that, I just want to say thanks again for being on the podcast, Angela. It's great to have you here.
Thank you.
And also, do you think you could talk a little bit about your job and how finding income plays into that to give our listeners a bit more of an idea about you?
Okay, great question. So in terms of what we do at Evergreen Consultants, we help financial planners build portfolios for their client bases. So really, you know, it depends on our client's client base as to what we're trying to do for each of them. But I can say that over the past couple of years, the idea of income portfolios is becoming more and more important, and we're having more and more discussions about them and how to potentially structure them. I think it's a really tough question in this world, and a lot of the answers probably aren't the things that we, you know, relied upon 5 or 10 years ago. It's really hard. So we're having a lot of really deep and complex discussions at the moment with a lot of our clients about, you know, how to generate yield and what that might look like in the future.
You said that that building income portfolios has become more and more important over the last few years. Why do you think that it has become more important?
Well, because defensive parts of portfolios used to be able to do two things. If we think back even before the GFC, defensive portfolios did two things. They actually were defensive. That is, they protected you if the market fell, depending on the circumstances, but, you know, often did. And they also generated a lot of yield. I'm not sure if you remember, but during the GFC, you could still get a 5-year term deposit yielding 7%. So you could buy term deposit for the defensive part of your portfolio, know that you're not going to have any capital loss. The only sort of risk you were taking was bank risk, and often that was government guaranteed anyway. And you could get a 7% yield. Like, that's just not available anymore. So the defensive part of a portfolio, now you really have to think about whether you want it to be defensive or generate income. And if it's to generate income, it's probably not all that defensive. With that sort of conundrum occurring, you start to have to look for income from different parts of your portfolios, maybe growth assets. You know, Australian equities have been the highest dividend yielders in the world for over 100 years, right? Yeah. So, you know, that was always traditionally a great place. That's not so much the case anymore with all the dividend cuts and so on. Hopefully that's only transitory. So, you know, it's just more difficult to get that income out of a portfolio now.
Okay. Excellent. Thank you for that summary. I think that sums, I guess, perfectly what we're going to end up talking about today as well. We'll get into that a bit deeper in a moment.
Yeah.
I wanted to open the floor to Damien and Angela first off and talk about markets and a bit of a market update, because we've obviously seen a couple of quite significant down days in the S&P 500 this week. And Damien, I think you were talking to The Australian earlier this week about whether or not it's the right time to buy. I wanted to just sort of get a bit of a feel of an update from both of you about, have things changed over the last week or the last couple of weeks? Or is it really just markets doing their thing and being volatile?
Right. Well, I'll kick off first, and that'll give Angela a chance for the right of reply, or to either to agree or disagree.
Yeah.
But better that than I'm disagreeing with a guest in the first conversation. We'll say the disagreement for later.
Damien, I will defer to your greater intellect.
I guess one of the big things that's changed, and we've got a chart up there just showing the rise in cases just in the last week or so, that you can just see has gone dramatic in Europe, and dramatically higher, and shutdowns are happening across Europe. There was a really interesting article, I thought, a few weeks ago from John Hempton, just talking about, you know, this idea that even if shutdowns don't happen, then actually when the infection rates really pick up, people just stop doing stuff anyway. So you either get government mandated shutdowns, or you actually get people stopping to do things. And so it seems pretty obvious that that's going to be circling through Europe again. So sort of back into that phase. But the larger issue over the whole thing is that the fundamentals are just nowhere near where the markets are. And so markets could fall a long way before you actually get back to fundamentals. And so, I think the question now is, we need government stimulus if you want markets to hold higher, but you're probably not going to get government stimulus unless markets start falling a bit, so the politicians are sort of prompted into getting out and spending more money. So, I do think there's a... I do think we're in for a period of weakness at some stage. If you went sideways for a few years and earnings growth was quite good, you could still end up with expensive markets in 2 or 3 years' time. So, yeah, I think it's a mixture of the two. Angela?
Yeah, I'll add a couple of things. I think you're right. Obviously there's definitely a part of the markets that's reacting to the number of COVID cases that are coming through, and all of that slowdown and shutdown that's occurring as a result of that. But I also think obviously the upcoming election next week is starting to maybe weigh on markets a little. So there's definitely an element of that. You usually see coming into a US election, particularly if they think there's either going to be a change of government or a change into Democrats, that markets are weak. That hasn't happened this time as much. So maybe we're just seeing a little bit of that prior to the election. But that's, that's definitely something that you generally see in the lead up to the election. So markets just don't like that sort of change. In terms of your idea of, valuations, I think you're absolutely right. Valuations, particularly in parts of the market, are just sky high. And to expect some volatility as a result of that is absolutely normal and what we should be seeing. But in terms of the fiscal stimulus, I just sort of think that regardless of who wins next week, they're going to spend money. The Democrats are going to spend more money than the Republicans, but the Republicans are still going to spend a lot of money. So I think fiscal stimulus is coming. And I think markets have been buoyed by huge monetary stimulus that we've had and the huge fiscal stimulus, which is likely to come. Exactly when, I'm not sure, but, maybe January or something like that. But I suspect, you know, markets are buoyed by just this huge amount of cash that's coming, I think.
Well, and this question about how much, and how, well, actually, we could spend a fair bit of time talking about this, but I will actually ask one question, because this is the one we're sort of weighing on, is the whole, we think there's a positive in terms of if Biden wins, in that you sort of get, yes, there will be a big stimulus.
Yep.
On the flip side, there's going to be tax rises, so you can cut 10% more off earnings, but the market doesn't care about earnings anyway, so what's it matter?
Yeah.
I think it's good in the longer term for the bigger fiscal sphere, more. But the issue is, which I suspect why markets are also a little bit concerned, is some of Trump's numbers have been up in the last few days. Is the idea that, well, if Trump wins the Trump wins on the night, because there's a lot more Republicans voting on that day, but then this huge wave of postal votes comes in and Biden wins. But in the meantime, Trump's declared victory and, off to the courts to complain that those postal votes don't count because, whatever the reasons are that he's got.
That's probably the biggest risk. I mean, I think that's what markets fear most, right, is some sort of contested election result, because it could be months till we know who's the actual winner.
Mm. Yeah. And hopefully not a civil war later. Yeah, there's I think that's Rubini put one out a piece talking about the probabilities of how you can get to a civil war, and it's like oh really, that didn't seem that hard. But I don't know whether there's anything on that front that you're sort of doing in portfolios to try and protect your position.
Not so much protect at this stage. I think at this stage we're actually sort of buoyed by a couple of things. You know, obviously this massive stimulus, no matter how it comes. So, I mean, we don't tend to be really short term in the way that we manage portfolios with clients. It's, there's too many transaction costs and it can be difficult to do well. So we tend to be a bit more medium term. Like we made a number of moves through March and April, but, we wouldn't be making moves, with a 1 or 2 week view. That's sort of not, that's a bit difficult for us. But I think we're sort of generally, even though, valuations are so high, we just sort of think that there is no alternative at the moment. You know, rates are so low, yields are so low, like we've already mentioned, that you have to sort of be in growth assets, because everybody's going to support you. The Fed's going to spend, that whatever government is in place in the US, they're going to spend. So it sort of buoys these markets. So we're tending to probably just err on the side of being in growth assets, but we're very diversified. So trying to stay away, not just do the FANGs, which are where the valuations are crazy, but, diversify across different types of stocks and stuff like that.
Mm. Anyway, let's go, Chilly, I'll back to you. Let's talk yield, because we can spend the whole time talking.
We'll get back to growth assets, especially given that we're going to be talking about is growth and new income. So then the next couple of slides, I've just got up the S&P 500, and it's a slide of the US Fed's Treasury and mortgage-backed securities holding, which obviously kicked off in earnest back in 2009, the GFC, with quantitative easing. And we've seen similar sort of interventions from the BOJ and the ECB as well. And you can see that on that slide. And obviously that's had a huge impact on valuations. And it's interesting, Angela, you said, pre-GFC you used to be able to get 7% on your term deposit. And now I think that's below 1%. So this government stimulus has had quite a significant impact on markets. And if I skip to, I think it's slide 5, there's a chart of the risk return trader for the efficient frontier, which shows that, basically increasing returns requires you to take on additional risk. And so, term deposits, typically low risk, and then moving up into equity, you're increasing your risk, but also your return. And so I think for yields and income, when you're searching it, what we've seen is people going up that the frontier or increasing risk to try and chase that income, but doing it with like unknowingly or
unknowingly. Yeah.
Yeah, thank you. What do you think, Angela?
Yeah, look, that's what QE has done. This is the world we've lived in since the GFC. You know, it sort of didn't hit us as quickly as it hit places in the like the US, because US interest rates, particularly short-term interest rates, went down to zero really quickly, right, through the GFC. So there you saw investors pushed out to riskier assets just to try and get any type of return much more quickly than it happened here. We were lucky because, as you say, like through the GFC, it was even sort of, towards the end of the GFC, cash rates here were really quite high. And we've only really seen those cash rates fall to, let's call it unacceptable levels in the past couple of years. Before that, you could still get threes, fours, fives in term deposits and people could live off that. But now you're at, as you say, sub one, and you're in that world where we're in the world now that the US has been in for the last 10 years. This is a QE world. Interest rates give you nothing. So you really have to start looking at greater risk to either generate yield or growth. And if it's growth, you might convert that to yield or whatever. The problem is that once you start to move out to those more risky assets, is that they are more risky and the outcomes just aren't as known. So, you know, you might be betting to try and get some growth, but you may not. It's just that the whole world has been doing that. So the whole, I guess, weight of money has gone into those assets, like, you know, growth assets, like, you know, equities and so on. So we've seen those prices rise well and truly.
And we spoke last time, Angela, when I was talking about this, but, you know, we've got, you know, some bonds in our portfolio that we've got there, not because they've got a great yield, but because when I'm talking government bonds, not corporate bonds. But because we actually think we'll get some capital growth out of them as Australian interest rates chase the rest of it, and then you've got equity sitting there for the yield, and it's sort of saying, well, it's just been, isn't it the whole thing meant to be the other way around?
Yeah. Well, yeah, look, yeah, you're right. 10, 15 years ago, we relied on bonds for the yield. Yeah, absolutely. And equities were all about growth, but now we're relying on equities for all of it. And government bonds, as you say, for, you know, some sort of defensive element. The other thing that government bonds still will give you, if there is a massive crisis like a March, April period again, they will still give you protection. Mm. They'll still, you know, rates can still fall. And they'll give you protection in that respect.
Yeah. And Australia's got the highest rates in the world, so in the developed world still, in terms of that. Like, it's 0.8 or whatever for the 10-year. International, like the Germans, like negative 0.8, or, you know, so right through Europe is negative, and you know, Canada, New Zealand's got sort of, you know, zero rates for at the 5-year level. So
yeah, it's crazy. I mean, so another place people are looking at to try and get some yield out of fixed interest is like Asia, you know, but there's a whole heap of other risks there. But people are definitely looking at emerging market debt to try and get yield as well, because a lot of those markets are still trading at, you know, fives and fours, so you can get 4 or 5% yield.
Yeah,
and I guess taking on currency and all sorts of other stuff, of course.
Well, that's right. So I guess that's the question for me for those. I mean, that's never been something in ours, because we've just sort of, well, you know, emerging market debt, you know, the first person they're going to default on is foreign investors, and
there's definitely a lot more risk in there. Definitely,
yeah. And I'd argue it's probably it's possibly even greater than the risk you're running in equities. And so you're basically saying, well, I might be getting a 5% return, but that's capped. I'm not getting any more than 5%, and it could be zero,
Negative. It could be negative 100.
Yeah, that's right.
There's definitely another set of risks that I'm not sure that everybody fully understands, but they're definitely being marketed at the moment as an alternative, you know, for yield.
Yeah. Well, actually, that I did want to get onto that. Actually, that's probably a good. It's probably a good segue. So, whenever it does pop up, you know, when there's lots of free money around, there's always somewhere that people are out there marketing. And we saw that one. What was it called? The Mayfair, was it?
Mayfair 101. Yeah.
Mayfair marketing, sort of whatever, 7 or 8% fantastic yields, and now everyone's wondering where all the money went. So what's the latest version of that? So you think it's emerging market bonds? Is that the one doing the rounds? Or what's...
Oh, yeah. Look, I don't think it's quite as bad as Mayfair 101. I mean, it is a real asset class and there are real assets out there. So I don't think it's sort of, you know, I guess the next Ponzi scheme.
No, I guess I'm talking, probably more talking about what's more the flavour of the, what's the high-risk flavour of the minute that gets pushed off?
There's heaps of stuff. There's heaps of stuff we're seeing. So the sorts of stuff we're seeing play to both income and potentially growth. So we're seeing a lot of growth in things like private debt funds. You'll know that there's structural changes in the way that banks are lending here in Australia and that they're pulling out of some parts of the lending market. So a lot of private debt funds have sort of come in and started to take their place. So a lot of those will yield 8%. But the trade-off that you have is that it's illiquid. So, you sign up to a fund and you can't take your money out for 5 years, but they're offering you, say, 8%, for example. So we're seeing a lot of private debt. We're seeing some emerging market debt, as we've sort of talked about. The other things that we're seeing it really plays on the idea of this risk return. So stuff up the top of the risk spectrum here, lots of private equity and lots of venture capital type funds. A lot of those really, traditionally risky type assets, we're seeing lots and lots of stuff. We're also seeing lots of micro cap funds, so funds that invest in not penny dreadfuls, but something close to that. They'll be really small. They might cap it, say, $50 million. You put your money in. It's liquid, but it's not super liquid. Like, you wouldn't want to be pulling your money in and out. They often close to new investment because they can only take, say, $50 million. So we're seeing a lot of that sort of stuff. Lots of private equity, both global and Australian. Lots of venture capital. Everywhere.
And how much of that, do you think... how much do you think the Australian super funds are adding to that? Because they've obviously got some pretty big unlisted assets within their mandates now.
Yeah. They definitely have a lot of appetite for that sort of stuff. I think a lot of the things that tend to be marketed more to, say, retail clients or to financial advisors aren't on exactly the same scale. Because super funds are so large, they can only look at very large providers of private equity type funds because they're really allocating, billions of dollars as opposed to 50,000 or whatever. So the sort of stuff we're seeing tend to be smaller private equity funds. We are seeing some large private equity funds for sure. KKR came to the market last year and so on. But we're definitely seeing a lot of the smaller groups coming and they're looking for, a million, 100 million, whatever. So just these smaller amounts. So they're not really super fund territory. And the same with venture capital because the amounts are so small that should be invested. Super funds really struggle because they just have such large amounts of money to allocate. So they're not in exactly the same sort of market. We see a lot of VC stuff that is really tiny companies, that they're investing in really tiny companies.
They're not really for yield though, is it? Whereas I can see what's sort of
that's private
right.
That's taking, stuff. Yeah. No, that's nothing to do with yield. It's really about that whole just weight of money trying to, get some sort of return and, it looks like a growthy part of the market. Private lending might be something for super funds, but again, it's all about the scale. To get a super fund involved, you really need to be able to offer huge amounts of scale. And a lot of the things that we see just don't have that sort of size to them. And that's very much a yield play. Another thing that super funds are looking at a lot and have done for probably a decade now is infrastructure, because they also often, those sorts of assets often give good yields and they often are some contractually, obligated type yields, often to a government or something like a toll road or a pipeline. So they often can give good yields like 5-6% and are often inflation adjusted. So they go up with inflation. Inflation's not an issue now, but there's definitely a lot of commentators talking about the idea that inflation will come back in the next few years. So infrastructure is definitely an area super funds love. It helps them lock into objectives, comparatively easily.
Yeah, and the question in that area for me is that I think we looked at something quite recently on the Harvard and Yale, because they sort of, I guess they.
Yes.
They brought out this a lot, you know, 20-odd years ago about saying, yeah, you go into these unlisted assets and you get all this liquidity premium and you get to buy the assets for cheaper. Illiquidity premium. Illiquidity discount. And you get to buy the assets for cheaper and so your returns are higher. But both those have actually had, you know, pretty bad 5-year and I think even 10-year returns in terms of and sort of part of the reason is because so many people are now investing in some of these unlisted assets. The argument is, well, there's actually no real discount anymore, and so you get no liquidity, but you don't get a premium, you don't get a discount for it. Yeah. And some of the assets are actually starting to get very expensive.
Infrastructure is an interesting asset class in that respect. A lot of the listed assets are trading at a discount to the unlisted assets because now people talk about a control premium. So owning it in an unlisted format gives you a control premium you don't have if it's listed.
Yeah, we can pay the bribes quietly and we don't have to be reported to shareholders.
Yeah.
I might jump in there because Angela's comments about super funds and their scale and also the monetary stimulus we've had and the lack of inflation, I wonder if it is worth talking a little bit about real returns because obviously that efficient frontier that we were talking about before, scaling up and down in terms of risk you're taking on and the returns you're getting, that's in terms of real returns. And when you talk about the deposit rates having fallen from 7 or 5% to below 1% now, that's nominal. So can we just break down, I think, Damien, when we talked about this before, you've highlighted that it's a fall in the real return and the inflation as well, but I'm not sure I fully understand what's driven the fall in the real return.
Right. So my take on it is so central banks are trying to ease up conditions, ease up financial conditions and get people out there and spending. And so what the idea is that if you lower interest rates enough, then you get people get out there and borrow and they start pushing markets up. But because there's the Taylor rule, which is sort of like a question about how much growth you can get for relative to interest rates, basically saying what you need is negative interest rates. And so so if you just look at things on a nominal basis, you'd miss the fact that in higher growth environments, people can actually afford to lend more money, and the growth just naturally higher inflation that just eats away at your debt. Whereas once your growth rate starts getting lower, you actually have to start pushing your interest rates much lower. So we've been at negative real interest rates, so interest rates have been below or below inflation for some time now. And now we're starting to go, well, how much more negative can we take real rates? So I guess it's an eye about saying if you've got zero interest rates and you have 4 or 5% inflation, that's very different to having zero interest rates with only 1% inflation. It's not as stimulatory.
I guess in terms of that idea, the nominal rate is obviously just the real rate plus inflation. So you're right. I mean, I think with QE, the idea of QE back in the GFC was that, as you say, like pump a lot of money to the banks who would then lend it out and create stimulus that way. So what seemed to not work is that the lending bit didn't happen as much as central banks really wanted. So it just didn't stimulate the real economy as much. What seemed to happen is it all got fed into financial assets instead. So we had this sort of situation where the real economy was comparatively weak or not strong. We didn't have a lot of pricing pressure coming through, so not a lot of inflation at all, and not a lot of, you know, sort of demand growth, but we did see a lot of money make their way into financial assets. So it didn't really work, I think, the way a lot of people thought it would or hoped it would. So this time round, they've done the QE bit. They actually have changed bits about the way it gets lent out. So hopefully that will push lending to a greater level. But the other thing that we have this time, which is different, is the fiscal stimulation, which we didn't have last time. Governments didn't spend a lot last time. In the US, the government took on a lot of the bank debt and stuff like that, so they nationalized some of the corporate debt, but they didn't actually stimulate the way that they have this time. So there was no JobKeeper programs last time, for example.
In fact, we had austerity, didn't we, in some European countries?
Yes, they did exactly the opposite. You're absolutely right, Shelley. And that has, you know, obviously caused, you know, that they've never grown. Those European nations just haven't grown anywhere near as much as the US or us since the GFC. So this time with that fiscal stimulus, the idea is that potentially that's going to be much more inflationary because that money often goes directly into the pockets of people who will spend it. And that can cause a lot more, you know, consumption growth and potentially inflation. So it's definitely something markets are talking about a lot. No one's expecting it this year or even next, but they're definitely talking about it being an issue in 2022, for example. The thing is markets do react once they start to price it in. So we're not going to have to wait till 2022, if it is coming, for markets to start pricing that way.
And so, okay, so we're going to get inflation possibly from this money getting into the real economy now. And does that mean we're going to get real return as well? Do they go hand in hand?
No, each year return, the other way around.
Yeah, I wish it was that easy. No, not necessarily. It just, you know what it means? It means that the environment that we invest in will be significantly different to the one that we've invested in for the past 30 years because we've been in an environment for at least 30 years now
interest rates are falling.
Yeah, interest rates are falling. Sorry, I've just had a problem with my computer. No, it's all good though now. Yeah, that's right, where interest rates have been falling and inflation has been falling. So we may be in a situation in the next couple of years where inflation starts to rise, and that really does change the investment environment, if I put it that way.
Mm. And I guess my caution to that is, you know, post the financial crisis, we saw a letter written to Bernanke at the time by all these esteemed economists who all basically said, hey, what you're going to do is going to be, you know, dramatically inflationary and it's going to cause, you know, hyperinflation and you know, you're on the wrong path. Yep. And none of that came about. And I guess what I'd say is that I think we need more fiscal stimulus than what we've got. I think we've sort of shown that, and Japan's probably decisively shown you can't cause inflation with just the you can cause inflation in asset markets, but you can't cause it in real inflation with quantitative easing. And so you do need serious fiscal spending, and what we've done so far isn't enough. It needs to keep going.
Yeah. So. Look, you know, there's a range of views out there. It's not my place to sort of, you know, say my view's right or anything like that. But what you're expressing is, you know, pretty much what a lot of people are saying. But it's definitely something that I guess is on the agenda again, and it hasn't been for a number of years. So, you know, I think that's what's interesting. And, you know, it doesn't have to come about. If markets react like it is going to come about, then that's a world we have to understand. So you're definitely right. It's not baked in. But it's something that people are starting to look for again. You're right, everybody, like a lot of people expected it after the GFC with the amount of monetary stimulus we got, and it didn't happen at all. Yeah. It's definitely not going to happen in the short term.
Yeah, but if Biden gets up, I mean, I think already as Biden's polls have improved, you've sort of seen some of the longer-term bond yields have risen in the US.
Yes.
Not dramatically, but, you know, a little bit. So certainly that point that if Biden gets up, then the expectation will be that there'll be much bigger fiscal stimulus and so therefore
maybe some inflation.
Yeah, that's right.
So okay, so I'm really trying to understand real return because I feel like if you are a retiree and you are really dependent on a portfolio that you're generating income off, that real return is really important to you. So is that going to continue to be as low as it has been? Or is there a risk that it's going lower? Or is there something that could cause it to increase?
Well, yes, real is very, very important, except for the fact that we live in a nominal world. So there's some things that are funny around the zero bound. And I think one of them is that, and I think we've spoken about this a few times in the podcast in the past, is that if you're earning a 6% return on your term deposit and there's 3 or 4% inflation, then you're actually only earning a 2 or 3% return, but it's sort of hidden, and so you feel pretty good. You, every year you might be spending that whole 6%, and your balance isn't going down, but you feel good about yourself. Whereas in reality, you've actually lost 2 or 3% of your real money every year. And I guess what we've been saying to people is, you know, now that inflation's even much lower, you might just have to start adding into your capital. And so you might actually only be going backwards in a real sense, 2 or 3% per annum. But that's not different to how you were when interest rates were 6% and you were using the whole lot and inflation was much higher.
Yeah, so it's a psychological thing.
Yeah, it is. It is. Look, a lot of retirees don't like to eat into the capital. But the reality is, you know, a lot of people have to. It's just, you know, it's the way it is. People should expect to, you know, start to eat into their capital through retirement in order to, you know, maintain their standard of living, usually. Okay. That's usually how it has to work.
Tough conversation to have, though, if you're in a financial advisor.
Very tough conversation to have. It's all about the objectives of the client, right, and what it is they actually want to do with that money and how they want to manage it, yeah.
Yeah. But for anyone listening as well, you know, I guess if you have, you know, unless you feel like you absolutely have to leave every single penny you've ever earned back to your kids, you know, should be part of
your
life.
You saved it up for your retirement.
Yeah.
Not theirs.
Yeah, you've done right by them, and you've, you know, you give them an education and kick them out the door at 18 and whatever at 38, then spend your money. You know, it's other people's responsibility to look after themselves. Yeah,
absolutely. But a lot of people do have that, you know, seem to feel that need to pass on, I guess, that whole capital value at the end of their lives. But you're absolutely right. You should be spending it for you.
And can I just ask around that, is it actually that they feel they need to pass it on, or that there's a fear of not knowing how long they're going to live for and therefore running out?
Yeah, there's all those sorts of things. Both, yeah. It's all mixed up together.
Yep. Mm. Yeah, and I think that's where, you know, where the planning side can help in terms of saying, okay, well, I can see that if I spend this much amount of money and I get, you know, in worst case scenarios, here's where it'll end up, and in best case scenarios, you know, here's where I end up, and you can sort of see that. You can get some comfort in terms of where it goes from that perspective.
Yeah, absolutely. And there's also, you know, I guess Centrelink type things in how you structure those payments that can make a big difference as well. So there's a whole heap of stuff that's not investment related that can be really important during that period of your life.
Absolutely. I'm just trying to figure out actually just quietly where we're up to on the slide deck, guys. We've covered off on a lot in the last 15 minutes, so I apologise to anyone who's watching live. That I'm just wondering, we've got the review of the traditional income sources. Were we happy to skip through most of that? I feel like we're probably taking that as read now.
Yeah, skip.
Well, actually, no, I wouldn't mind going one by one and just seeing some of them we might skip past, but as we go through.
Start with term deposits.
Sure. Who'd like to begin?
Next one in, I think, Tim.
Yep.
So we've got a chart up of just showing exactly what you're talking about there, that we were spoken about term deposits coming down, and you know, online savers to zero. I guess we've been kicking around this whole idea that with the way the government's structured the RBA's structured this 3-year term funding facility, is that actually that's the most important thing rather than the overnight rate anymore.
Yeah.
And that, and the banks can lend from that at 0.25. And so the incentive to pay somebody a deposit on a term deposit much above that is not
very high. Absolutely. Yeah.
And the European experience was they started at 0.1. Then they went to negative 0.4 and now they're at negative 1. So basically the European Central Bank pays banks 1% to lend money out. So if you're a bank and you want to lend somebody on a home loan, you've got a choice of either going and paying somebody some money for a term deposit or going and getting the government to pay you literally 1% in order to take that money and lend it out. There's not a lot of incentive to offer term deposits. And I'm speculating that's where Australia's headed. So,
yeah, I think you're probably right, or you know, close enough to right. Absolutely, term deposits aren't going to be attractive for investors for a long time.
You want to go
bonds?
Bonds. Yeah. So we're sort of, I don't know, we've been. You can see those lines on the chart. Anyway, here, who's just listening in on the podcast instead, is, you know, we've just got the government bonds over time, and you can see Australia you know, at one of the highest in the world all the way down. US briefly jumped in front of us, but I'm pretty sure this must be an older one. But we're back in front of we're back higher than the US again. But every other country is below zero. This is only up to 2019. Yeah, everyone else is negative at the 10-year bond rate. And so we're sort of playing for the view that that we think, you know, Australia relative to global funds, there's a little bit more capital growth in some of them. Having said that, we're not taking too much risk at the long end because at the moment anyway, because I do think a Biden election probably will see a bit of a deflation scare, whether you actually get real inflation. But I do think, as Angela said, it's what people start pricing in is what's important.
Yeah.
So I wouldn't be telling people to take huge amounts of risk at that end, but
No, and we're similar. We've been sort of positioned like that for a long time, and it's sort of been right most of the time and wrong some of the times. Those assets still definitely give you some defensive characteristics and give you some protection, but you can't be buying them for yield anymore, and you're not going to be able to for a long time. And there is definitely some possibility that you could lose money in an inflationary scare like Damien's, sort of outlined. You could definitely see that.
In the longer term ones. In the shorter term ones, it's not.
Yeah. In the shorter term ones, yeah. Absolutely. Yeah. No, you're right. Yeah. It's more that longer term stuff that's where the most risk is. Yeah.
Yeah. And I found very interesting that the New Zealand government, New Zealand Central Bank basically said, we might go to negative interest rates at some stage. And almost instantly, the 5-year in the US went negative. It's 5-year in New Zealand. And so that thought about going, the RBA is very much against it at the moment, but they've been very much against everything all the way down. And so if at some stage they do say negative interest rates, then, it didn't take long to...
The market will price that, And you can see, this graph is great because you can see it's actually been, a good 40 years that rates in Australia and globally have just fallen the whole time. We haven't been in a world where interest rates have risen for a long time, where inflation's been rising.
Yep, absolutely. And I mean, there's some argument. I think we had a whole one on this with a technology guy who basically had some quite reasonable arguments about how technology's changes is actually accelerating in a number of areas, which is just keep holding inflation down as well. Plus, then the whole globalization part, which sort of led to it's very hard to get a pay rise to be a call center desk.
If you can go to Indonesia or Malaysia or whatever. Yeah, right. But definitely some of that's changing, right? So there's definitely geopolitical stuff going on that, where globalization is sort of, reversing a bit. That definitely could help to push inflation upwards.
Yeah. So I guess what I'm positing though is you need a few of those to come off, which is all. You could make the assumption, if you made the assumption, yes, governments will spend way too much money and they'll put in all these lockdowns to try and get wages higher, then you can definitely say yes, inflation's going to be higher. But there's a few steps to that. There's a leap of faith you need to take on that.
Yep. I'll buy that.
What do we got? What do we got next, Tim? What's our
pennies in front of the steam?
Actually, sorry. On government bonds, do you do anything in inflation linked bonds?
No, we don't. Primarily because there's not a lot here in Australia that can be done. We do definitely. There's definitely a couple of funds out there that we look at that are investing quite heavily in those sorts of instruments. Yeah, I was talking to a multi-asset manager the other day, and their portfolio at the moment is 22% inflation-linked bonds and about the same amount in gold.
All right. And so they must be a figure that inflation's going to run.
Yeah. Well, as I said to them, so it's just going to be chaos until we get inflation. And they went, that's pretty much what we think. So there's definitely a big range of views out there about what's going to happen in the world.
Yeah.
More than we've seen for a long time.
Yeah. And see, as you were speaking before about inflation, the inflation benefits of having some of these infrastructure assets. And I look at inflation-linked bonds and go, at the right price, I love inflation-linked bonds because you buy them, you get that, you don't have to worry about inflation, it ticks up. But I just, we just struggle with the pricing all the time. Oh, so not just all the time. Recently, we struggle with the pricing. Just we think the inflation,
yeah.
We've ended up in the fixed rate ones just because we we really want to buy inflation linked ones, but we just can't find them. We
can't
get at the right price. So, yes. Okay. Corporate bonds.
Yeah, let's jump across to those.
Yep. So, corporate bonds. Yeah, as a general rule, we like them. Obviously, it will look. There's a lot of I guess issues potentially around default. Defaults in the US this year so far have been significantly higher than last year, and I think we all can understand why next year might be worse again, as a lot of this, a lot of the sort of packages are withdrawn. So, there's definitely going to be heightened levels of defaults. So you have to be very careful about where you invest in corporate bonds. But there's still definitely a place where there is some comparatively good yield. So it's an asset class that does include some risk, but you can do better out of them than sort of standard government bonds in terms of yield for sure. Yeah. So that's how we're generally thinking about them. You need good managers through there.
Yeah. Well, and I think that's one of those things about having an index position in that. I'm not convinced an index position is going to do that well.
Because you'll agreed.
An A-listed corporate bond trading at 1% and saying, just a minute, so I'm going to give these guys money. The best I can ever do is 1% per annum, and the worst I can do is,
minus 100.
100, but yeah. That doesn't sound like, a great trade-off.
I agree. And it's interesting because a lot of credit spreads now are at the same levels they were in February. So, we had this massive dislocation, the worst recession in 100 years, and credit spreads in some pockets are as tight as they were before any of this happened.
Well, this looks even lower. Shelley, when was this chart? When was the left chart from? Is that that's a recent RBA paper, is it?
I actually don't know the date.
I think it is, yeah, but I'm pretty sure that's maybe the spreads haven't changed as much, but it's the spreads around the
same levels. It depends, right? Like exactly, but give or take, they're a little higher, I think, just in general on average, but they're not far from February. The only things that haven't come right back in are the really really high risk things. But some of the securitized assets. So there's some of the things that we haven't seen come back in. But, a lot of that was to do with the Fed, particularly in the States, the Fed stepping in and saying that they would buy, certain types of these sorts of products.
Yes.
And providing, really significant support to those markets.
Yeah, that's right. And I think they didn't even have to in a lot of them. They just said they were going to, and then by the time they got around to it, they don't need to anymore.
Yeah.
Already come in. So
yeah, but it's definitely an area to look at. But to pick up some yield.
Yep. As I said, I think I said we're finding the risk return ratio in that area not
a bit difficult
at the moment. Yes. Yeah.
I think it depends on exactly what you're looking at. Yeah, but look, I can see what you're saying for sure.
In terms of we've had a view for a while that hybrids just don't give that you basically, yes, you step up a little bit on the income side, but you step up a lot on the risk side.
Yeah.
And you may as well just be in the equities.
Agreed.
If that's your thing. Yep.
Agreed.
Yeah. Because I know that's a bit of a favourite of brokers just to throw people into hybrids, but
absolutely. But you saw the volatility of them in March and April; they were extraordinarily volatile. So it depends on what you're looking for out of those assets. If it's really just yield, and defensiveness doesn't matter, I don't know. Maybe that's something to look at. But hybrids really are a halfway house between debt and equity. So you really have to think about what it is you want from them.
That's right. All the upside of debt, all the downside of equity. That's it.
Yeah.
Yes. Okay. So what was it? So in this, I guess while we're in this, so you spoke a little bit about some funds you're looking at. So from the better alternative income fund managers, where do you think they're looking in on the? Are they looking at the higher yield ones, or are they trying to get the lower yield ones and leverage them, or what's the play there?
Look, it depends on the fund manager. We're like what we're seeing a lot of is stuff like private debt. So in terms of good alternative income managers, I think a lot of them are struggling generally. Yeah, some of them are doing some leveraging, but it's sort of a bit difficult. Some of them are going into some of the higher risk stuff. We're definitely seeing some managers liking part of the high yield spectrum, but they're being, you know, pretty selective about it, as you'd like them to be. And I think, you know, everybody's wary that valuations generally are expensive. It's just that the regime at the moment, the monetary and fiscal regime, which doesn't look like it's going to change, is really basically supporting everybody in those positions. So you sort of sit there going, this doesn't feel great because everything's expensive. But looking around, the Fed or the central banks are telling me to be exactly here. And they're supporting me in this, and I'm not really sure how this is going to change. So, you know, there's sort of this risk-taking. I think a lot of people who've been around a long time and have seen markets for a long time feel a bit uncomfortable with the absolute levels that they're, you know, paying for things or, you know, where things are trading. But there's just no alternative. How are you seeing things in that respect?
We're sticking a lot with sort of cash and trading into some currencies a bit here and there to sort of pick up some thing. But I guess it's that problem, isn't it, where we look upon cash as effectively just the optionality benefit of it. Yes. Yep. It's giving you a chance to buy something else later at a cheaper rate.
Yeah.
And that's probably what we're trying to take advantage of. The problem, you know, people have is that it's hard to charge clients fees for cash, especially when cash rates are almost zero. And yep. I worry there's some managers out there who are basically saying, well, I could go into cash, but then I wouldn't make as much money myself, so I better stick into these assets. Otherwise I won't get paid. So, you know, so that's the dangerous part, I guess. We're trying to shuffle the assets a little bit as they're sort of moving up and down, but we're mainly just saying let's just try and conserve as much firepower as possible so that when we do get some opportunities, we've got some money there to take advantage.
Yeah. Yep. Well, there's quite likely to be opportunities at some point.
Yes. Yeah. What have we got next there, Tim?
So we're running through. We've got equity dividends. Just talking through dividend payout ratios. Kicking off with Aussie equity, and I think Angela mentioned before as well, Australia leading the way on high dividends versus the world.
Yeah, but not so much now, right? Because of the dividend cuts that we've had, which is really unfortunate because it has been an extraordinarily reliable source of income for a long time. And franking is so valuable. I mean, we're the only country in the world with franking, and people don't really think about how much that's worth, but it's worth a lot. It's not quite as good as it was, but it's still comparatively reliable and not a bad place to generate yield. But, yeah, look, unfortunately, it's just not quite as good as it was. How are you guys thinking about dividends in Australia? Yeah.
Well, I guess the biggest one we look at is the bank dividends.
Yeah.
And they're obviously, you know, we cleared out quite early in terms of the banks, and I think we had a piece out there sort of basically saying that the bank yields are unbelievable, but not in a good way. And I've sort of seen that come through now. And I guess I'm just looking at all the comparisons we saw internationally, where particularly Europe, where, you know, in the last 5 or 6 years, European bank shares are down 50%, while the rest of the market was up 50%.
Yeah.
And because they're stuck in this whole low yield perspective where they can't make the money because their yields are they're basically borrowing short and lending long, and so they're stuck in this unprofitable thing because of the how low the interest rates are. And I'm just looking at the Australian market going, well, unless we do actually get that stimulus that gets inflation going and gets everything going, then Australia's banks are headed in the same direction. It's just that grind lower and tough to pay dividends. The other thing is we've suspended the accounting for anyone not paying their bills. And so and that's coming off, well, I guess gradually.
Soonish.
And then a bit more in March. And so so I guess what we're looking at is the risks looks pretty high in that area. Which has been a huge I think a lot of Australians have treated banks as being, yes, stable dividends and I get capital growth as well. What more could I want? And just throw everything into it. And so we don't think that's going to be the case for a little while. So, and then REITs are very tough as well, because the office REITs and the retail REITs are hit very hard. And while industrial REITs have held up well and are interesting, they're actually pretty replicable. Like, most of them are just basically
shit in a paddock somewhere.
Yeah, somewhere near a freeway.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, but they are a comparatively good yielders. But yeah, you're right. There's nothing that's not, that's special about them. Look, it's definitely tougher than it was. Banks in particular, as you've pointed out. It's definitely not like it used to be. There's no easy answer to this.
And so we're trying to shuffle, and we've sort of got a mix of some stocks where we're going, okay, we're owning these ones for yield, and we probably think the yield's falling, the dividends will be falling, but not too fast.
Okay.
And then we've got some other ones in there that have got relatively low yields, but we actually think those ones are growing, and so we think the mix of the mix of all the stocks we've got will actually deliver a decent yield. But if you look at any one individually, you can sort of go, well, what are you doing with that stock in a yield portfolio? The yield's not high enough. And you're like, yeah, I think it's growing. And what are you doing with this one if it's going to go backwards? You're like, well, yeah, but I need some yield now. So it's sort of that trying to get that offset right.
Yeah. Yeah.
We've got a nice selection here. I might hand over to Shelley, because I know you did a great job in the last show just having a look at some of the sectors with the stocks rather. And we've got a panel of four dividend payment histories. There, Shelley.
Sure, thanks, Tim.
Run through that one.
So I think Damien was actually just touching on it. There's a couple of reasons why I put this in the deck. And so the first one, I guess, is that if you're looking to build an income portfolio that has a steady stream of income into the future, you need to be cautious of the stocks that you're putting in there and the pattern that they have for paying dividends. So maybe start with BHP. There was a period a few years ago where BHP and Rio were trying to sell themselves as yield stocks because commodity prices were really high and the cash profits were incredible, so were the dividends. But Damien, maybe you want to quickly highlight why you probably shouldn't think of the cyclical stocks as being yield stocks.
Yeah, absolutely. Especially the resources ones. I sort of feel as that's when you know you're at the top of the cycle, when people start saying, "Hey, look at the great yield you can get on BHP," is that they're volatile and they're basically resource companies have control over their costs, and that's about it. All their revenues are basically the whim of the market, and so the iron ore price can double, and all of a sudden this company is making 10 times what it made before, and then it can halve as well, and all of a sudden they're making zero. You need to treat those as being, I'd think of resource dividends as special dividends. Whenever they're just like, yes, it's great, fantastic, I've got some money back, but I can't rely on this to pay the bills if that's your retirement income.
Thanks. Go, Tim.
Yeah, I was just going to say, sort of a little bit of a stock picker's bonus, isn't it? Because if you can get the play right, given their income, being able to get the income projection right, well, you get the rise in capital, and then you also get the special dividend as well, Damien.
Yeah, well, and Angela touched on that issue about franking credits being so important. I mean, that's the thing to note as well, is that when we adjust for franking credits, when we adjust for payout ratios internationally and look at all the buybacks, what you find is that companies are often giving about the same amount away in Australia in dividends as what you get overseas from a dividend plus a buyback. But in Australia, there's this thing that companies, whenever they pay tax, they accrue these franking credits, and they're no good to the company because they're basically useless. They want to get them out to shareholders as much as possible. And that's why you'd often see BHP, rather than doing massive buybacks, they'd do these weird dividend/buyback things where basically a way to get, we've got all these franking credits, we need to get them out to our shareholders, how can we do it? And so that's why you saw those sort of funny things coming out from BHP and Rio to offload the franking credits that were otherwise worthless. And so that's part of the reason why you'll see spikes in dividends for them as well. Whereas if they weren't listed in Australia, what I would have expected was the dividend probably would have been much steadier, but they would have been doing some big buybacks from year to year.
Yep. Okay, fair point. We might just jump across to sector diversification just quickly, and just in interest of time as well, and before we into the tail end of the show, guys.
And I think there's a few questions up there as well we need to hit.
Yeah, we've got a couple of questions I want to fire through as well. Yeah, so maybe just you've got a great chart here just on the correlation and the importance of sector diversification, Damien, just to...
Yeah, so this is what I was talking about a minute ago, just trying to say, how do you get this balance between some stocks that are yielding all right at the moment and some other ones that are growing. But then the flip side is then turning around and saying, you also need to make sure that you're not going all in on the one theme. So if I'm out there buying travel stocks and I'm buying energy stocks and I'm buying, those those things that are all leveraged to the one thing, which is, okay, coronavirus is fixed and everyone starts traveling and around the world again, is that there's no real diversification from mixing sectors. Whereas if you're actually spreading out between different sectors, I'd have highlighted here, one of the ones, information technology and utilities often gives a decently low correlation. And so you can sort of feel, as long as I'm buying good stocks, I think they're like in the utility sector good stocks are like in the infotech sector, then they're probably not going to find that the same negative event forces both the dividends in both those sectors to fall away. That's one part. But the second thing, the big disclaimer on all this stuff is this is all historical correlations, and correlations change over time. And there's lots of models out there that give these fantastic returns based on historical correlations, but never work in future because correlations change.
Mm-hmm.
So,
and just expanding on that diversification, I think you sort of touched on there that the COVID, non-COVID sort of theme, a series of other things to think about.
Yeah, so we run a whole bunch of different ones. We run business model because that makes a big difference as well. So you might be in the energy sector, but there's guys in there that basically fly helicopters out to oil rigs, and there's other ones that own huge capital bits of equipment. So yes, they're both correlated to the oil price, but one of them's a services company, and the other one's the other one's CapEx. And so knowing what your split is between those, that you've got how much manufacturing and that, so that's not specifically sector based. Country exposures. We especially like to look for currency mismatches within stocks. So what we want to know is if you're a cement manufacturer, then you're pretty much competing with local people because nobody bothers to import cement; it's too heavy. Whereas if you're a Cochlear or someone like that, where you're producing primarily in one country and exporting to other ones, then you've got this currency mismatch. If you've got operations right around the world, then sort of a matter of trying to work out which currencies are your costs in and which currencies are your revenues in. And those, I guess it's the same thing about saying if you pick all one type of company, then you might find you're exposed to something you hadn't realized. And so that's one of those ones where we've got about half a dozen other sort of different slices and different dimensions we try and look at companies at to make sure that we're not putting companies into a portfolio that are all exposed to a factor that we hadn't really thought about.
Sure. Yep, very good. Thoughts on diversification, and then I might pop in a question for you, Angela.
Yep. Cool.
Okay, yeah, sure. I'll double cross the and this is probably really broadening the church of diversification, but I've got one here from Nick saying, "Hi, Angela, do you have an opinion on blockchain and its adoption by governments, central banks, and financial institutions, the broad economy?" I thought it was going to dive into cryptocurrency there for a minute, but I'm glad we didn't. So thoughts there?
No, I'm not a blockchain expert. I'll stay away from that one. I don't think I could add anything intelligent on that.
Okay. Yep. Sure. I'll head over to Damien.
Yeah, we had Eric on a few years ago talking about this. I think the main thing we basically went down this line is blockchain itself as a technology. We think is very useful, and I don't doubt it'll be adopted by governments and central banks and things like that. But blockchain isn't cryptocurrency. Blockchain's a technology. So if you're getting into cryptocurrency now, you basically got to say, well, the big problem with these things is while they're small, then governments can tolerate them. But actually, if they get large, then governments won't tolerate them anymore because governments like having a monopoly on being able to be the ones who issue currency. And so, there's room for these things to go up and go down. And, there's I wouldn't call it an investment. I'd call it a speculative instrument. So for people who want to play in that area, speculate, but don't. Yeah, I guess what I'm saying is don't. I think if you've got a view that this thing's going to be great and it's going to be, the whole world's going to use Bitcoin, and so I need to rush in and buy it now before it goes to $1 million a coin. Mm-hmm. I think you're having yourself on, because once it gets too big, governments have armies and they have all that type of stuff to maintain their monopoly over issuing their currency, and they're not likely to give that up.
Well put. Just a quick call out as well, as we're sort of tailing out the shows, for anyone else who's got any questions, feel free to drop them in the chat in the YouTube channel. I've got one here from I Am Johan. If inflation does occur, central banks may have to hike rates to curb runaway inflation.
Yep.
If this happens, it would push treasury yields up and equities to fall to move into safer bonds. I guess the question there is whether or not inflation expectations are in the short term.
Yeah, look, the person who asked that question is absolutely right. If inflation comes about and yields start to rise generally, then the way we value, way a lot of equities are valued, it's, the interest rate is absolutely central to that. So if interest rates rise generally, equity valuations will fall generally. Absolutely. Mm.
And it's this question about the central banks that Angela was talking about before, saying it's the question about saying if interest rates, say, went to 5% overnight, then yes, all these bonds are going to lose bucket loads of money.
Yeah.
But most government budgets can't handle that at 5%, and most consumers can't handle it. So you're basically you're going to crash your world economy. And so why are interest rates going up? Inflation's and so there's a little bit of a double-edged sword there, in that the interest rates are set by the central banks. They want to make sure they're not sending their governments broke, and they're not sending the people broke. And so
absolutely. Look, if something like that happened, it would be an absolute catastrophe. I think rates rose 1% overnight in 1994, and that was a massive dislocation of markets that happened then. So, anything of that sort of nature would be huge. But certainly, if rates were to just rise very slowly and steadily, then you wouldn't see the effect on valuation straight away. You would just see potentially, say, the equity market go sideways for a significant period of time or something like that. And you wouldn't see huge losses on bonds if yields were to move just slightly and slowly over time.
Yeah, and that was my point as well. Is we ran just some numbers of saying if interest rates move to 6% over 10 years, so a big move, and that's a 10-year rate, 6% over 10 years, and you just had a bond portfolio that in over 15 years it was just rolling off. Every year you had one bond and you just buy one and stick it on the end, is that you'd make basically, I think, 0.2% over that time period. So you weren't actually going to lose money.
Yeah, like you wouldn't feel like you've lost a whole heap of money, yeah.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah, you'll make very bad returns, but you're not going to lose money on that because.
And it would be Did you do any work on what equity returns might be like in that world?
Depends on the earnings front. That's the real thing there. But I mean, you could, in that world, if you had weakish equity returns, then you're basically going. You're probably going to go sideways for equities, and it'll be down a bit. Mm. But if you're if earnings were, that's if you had reasonable earnings. If you had weak earnings, then you're toast.
And isn't it just the broader issue is that if you think back to the debt levels in 1994 versus the magnitude of debt, when I say this, even if we just look locally in home loan debt that's being carried ostensibly because the government has sort of allowed this, I think, to drive the economy. It's fractional moves in the rising and falling of, you're talking about raising things to 6%. You struggle to see that ever happening again, wouldn't you? It's more like 0.6% or it's a fraction.
Not with our current levels of debt, absolutely. And I'd go further to say is they haven't been allowing it, they've been encouraging it. Yeah.
Exactly. Yeah, very good. All right, we'll wrap out the. We're getting closer towards the end of the show now. The future revealed. Now, I think we've covered a lot of this, but maybe we'll just summarise it for our listeners. And get those high level thoughts on the capstone of the show. Now the fun begins. In summary, looking at the growth assets are going to need to be included, and I think we sort of kicked off the show with this one, so I suppose we'll come full circle now.
Do you want me to have a quick summary and then let Angela edit? Is that?
Oh, look, either way, yeah, sure. Right. If you might as well go first, Damien, and then, Angela, it's the right of a blight.
Okay. So this is just the summary of what we've been speaking about. So needing more growth assets than what you have in the past. We think you're going to need high levels of portfolio management. I think that if you just took a set and forget and just went, yep, I'm just going to dump my money into a 60-40 portfolio and I'll see you in 20 years' time, we think your returns are going to be relatively poor under that scenario. We think you're going to need to be a bit more active than what you've been in the past, just given how expensive things are. And then trying to come up with these, how do you get income that's going to, how do you make sure that you can grow into your future income, that you've got that whole mix of income. And there are some tax advantages as well. And if you actually say that you're going to try and, for a lot of people, capital gains will end up being taxed lower than income. And so if it's a matter of saying, well, I'm picking up a little bit of extra capital gains, but then I'm selling a few assets every year in order to meet my livings standards, then there might actually be tax advantages to that rather than disadvantages. And so getting around that whole concept that there's no possible way you can eat into your capital is just a mindset that I think people are going to have to change.
Mm-hmm. Very good. Yeah. And Angela?
Yeah, look, you know, I broadly agree with everything Damien said. It's definitely nowhere near as easy as it used to be. Maybe capital gain is, you know, I guess in a tax sense, a better place to be. I think the problem with capital gain, though, is it's not quite as reliable as income used to be. So that the fact that you can't count on it year after year to be a set level is obviously an issue, whereas yield sort of had that characteristic, I guess, to some degree at least. You might have to look outside traditional assets, you know, go into assets that where your money's tied up a little bit, you know, whether it's some sort of syndicate or something like that. I mean, greater care is definitely necessary and better advice around those sorts of things. But sometimes they can be a way to sort of maybe generate a bit of yield. So maybe it's also about thinking outside the box and thinking about other things that can be done. Instead of sort of the traditional things that we look at for you know, generating yield.
Yep, very good. And I think that's right. And as that sort of Lifeline says, eating into capital may be a last resort, or it's cat food sandwiches, in a way sort of sums up the fact that for people looking for, the idea of old of keeping your capital and eating it too, I think is sort of long behind us. And so you've got to work out that whose lifestyle is going to be affected. Is it your lifestyle in retirement, or is it your kid's lifestyle after you're gone? So anyway, we'll come down to priorities. We'll jump across to the investment outlook. Damien, you want to kick off with thoughts on the budget?
Yeah, just touching again. So I won't spend too much time on this because I think we've probably done it pretty much over the whole course. But yeah, just important to note that the Australian budgets, we've had this big supply side response, but the real problem is demand side. And so our view in Australia is until we actually see some demand side, so actually stuff more to support individuals rather than trying to convince companies that they need to go out and hire people, is that, you know, we're going to be stuck in this low growth environment in Australia, and they're probably going to need to go again. It's worth noting that, you know, we've got tax cuts coming in Australia. On the flip side, there's tax hikes quite possibly in the US coming from the Biden. So it's a very different look at that. And we're sort of playing, we're looking very much at this third quarter reporting season, which is, it's sort of really interesting in that the results themselves have actually been pretty good. And we've seen we're talking about US companies mainly. Some of the things that come out is, one is that US is actually, next year's earnings in the US are actually looking like being roughly the same as what they were in 2019. Whereas for Australian companies, it's looking like being down about 20%. So it's actually quite significantly different, especially in response to how well each country's done with the virus. But by the same token, Japan, which has done really well with the virus as well, their earnings are down and going to be down like 15% still next year. So there's a it's it's obviously there's very obviously a K-shaped recovery going on in terms of, you know, some companies going up and other ones going down, but it's very much sector based, I guess. That's what the net effect for me coming out from that, even though it looks like Australia's doing badly and Japan's doing badly, I think that's just largely because that's where the stocks happen to be in those sectors where they've got a greater exposure to, say, banks in Australia and industrial manufacturers in Japan that have been hit a lot harder than what have some of the tech stocks and say health in the US. So yeah.
Thanks for that. Yep. And Angela, anything to add to that one?
No, not really, to be honest. No, I don't have anything to add on this topic.
Yep, summed it all up. Okay, no, very good. And as we sort of finish out the show, I'd extend an opportunity for you to share with our audience ways that they can follow your work and get in touch with you and what an ideal client might be for yourself.
Yep. So, look, we consult to wholesale groups, so financial planners, small institutions, charities, those sorts of groups. So, you know, our work is usually accessible to the end client through another party. So we work with, you know, some very good financial planners through the country, and we provide them with all the tools they need. We do write some stuff that goes, you know, I guess out more broadly, and you can often see that on our website. We've got two websites, actually. So one's evergreenconsultants.com.au. And the other one is evergreenratings.com.au. So, you know, we look at, I guess, on ratings, we look at, you know, a whole heap of different types of funds, like, you know, private debt and so on that we talked about today. And then on Evergreen Consultants, we look really broadly at asset allocation and how to build portfolios for specific requirements and so on.
Excellent. Okay, well, sure thing. And look, thanks very much for coming along today. You did a magnificent job on a great topic. And highly knowledgeable and plenty to add there. So, look, thanks for contributing to the show. And we look forward to getting you back on soon.
Yeah, well, thank you very much for inviting me. It's been great fun.
Wonderful. And thanks to you, Damien and Shelley, as well, for your efforts in another great show.
Thanks, Tim.
No problems at all. Guys, we'll jump across to our question of the week. So feel free to drop your answers into the comments. Question for this week is, which would you prefer between income or capital gains? So feel free to pop in that and perhaps some reasoning why as well, and we can work through those and perhaps chat about them later. I'll jump into coming up next week. So, of course, we actually have a double header. On Wednesday at 2:30 p.m., so just keep in mind the time change there, from our usual one, Australian Eastern Standard Daylight Savings Time. We are running a special live show to go through the current state of play with the fiercely contested election in the United States. As at that time, there'll be a series of scenarios that could have come out, so we'll just have to wait and see what that looks like. We look forward to pulling apart what we know and how the outcomes will impact global investment markets. Then, on Thursday, a day later, we'll be joined by innovator and technologist and friend of the show, David Morgan, back on to share his thoughts on a new boom in clean energy and why he feels this is the most profound disruption of the energy sector in over a century. We'll also be discussing how this may mean a new dawn for Australian manufacturing and perhaps a new future for Australian employment.
Yeah, I'll just add to that, Tim. Sorry to jump in. So David's... for anyone who hasn't seen, he runs a company that makes solar panels in Australia using robots, and you build your entire house full of it. So basically, the cost of a solar panel is actually cheaper than the cost of a wall. And so it's basically going, you stick that in and you get sort of free power. And so he's doing most of it in Australia, mostly with robots. And he's got some great insights on some of that whole manufacturing-led boom, and some of the real things that people are facing in that area.
Yep, absolutely. No doubt he's a pioneer in the renewable energy space. Can't wait to get an update on that one. So tune in next week. So Wednesday, the 4th of November at 2:30 for the election special, and Thursday, the 5th of November at 12:30 for the live chat with David Morgan. Head over to our YouTube channel, Nucleus Investment Insights, to have your questions answered along the way. And thanks again to all of those who've watched in live for another great episode, and to all those who asked questions. We hope you've taken away some great ideas. If you'd like to see more of our content, head over to nucleuswealth.com/content to stay up to date with news from us. Follow us on social media. And finally, if you know anyone who'd get something out of today's episode, let them know about it, share with a friend, and help our show grow. So thanks for tuning in from myself, Tim Fuller, and the team. And we look forward to catching you at the next one. Cheers.